It's Light the Tower, your daily look around the world of sports with Hall of Fame broadcaster and voice of the Texas Longhorns, Craig Way.
Say goodnight to this one!
And Horns 24/7 insider, Jeff Howe. On your live, local, and independent home for sports talk in Austin, The Horn.
It's a beautiful morning in Oklahoma City. I know that phrase might sound a bit oxymoronic to some, but when it's time for postseason baseball, hey, it's a beautiful time of year, right? Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Light the Tower on the Horn. 1049, 1019, AM 1260. We're live, local, and digital on the Horn app and at hornfm.com. My name is Craig Way, and I am smack dab in the middle of downtown Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, where the Big 12 Conference Baseball Tournament, the actual name is the Phillips 66 Big 12 Baseball Championship. The tournament begins tonight with a play-in game for the first time ever in conference play, 8-9 play-in game, West Virginia and Kansas, and the winner will face the Texas Longhorns tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock. Plenty to come on all of that. However, it is time, of course, to be joined by my co-host, the pride of Northwest Williamson County and a proud graduate of Florence High School.
Damn right.
Former All-District, and a former All-District offensive lineman for the Florence Buffaloes. You know him best for his outstanding work at Horns 24/7. And that, of course, includes the Blitz podcast, which rolls on the air tonight, does it not, Jeff Howe?
That it does, Craig. You know, speaking of Florence, Texas, I want to borrow an expression that I heard many a time in Florence, America. I can't use the whole thing and spell it out, but an analogy that it's hotter than a billy goat with three certain appendages. It is that kind of hot in the studio today. So be thankful
you know what?
You're not here.
I hear the little portable AC unit. I thought, what is something wrong with my equipment? If it's something here in the room, and I heard that quiet hum.
I've got the portable going right now. Otherwise, I would be sweating and doing this show. People watching on Twitch would have to watch me do the show shirtless, and Lord knows nobody needs to see that.
So it went out again because it was out yesterday, and then the crew came in and fixed it.
You can bring in our esteemed producer, Craig. He knows more about the situation. He's more abreast in the situation than I am at this point.
Well, he keeps abreast of a great many things. He is, of course, the purveyor and the majordomo of Flex ATX and the Thursday Flex. He joins us now. That would be Jonathan John Donaldson, J.J. Donaldson. You know him best as Snoop Daniel. Good morning, Snooper. What's the mystery with the temp in the building?
No, I think I feel. Do you feel cool air blowing? I feel it just right now.
I think it's the portable. I don't know. It's starting to cool down, but man, Bucky and Aaron, I don't know how they made it through the end of their show.
You can hear
sauna when they're in there.
You can hear it. Oh, I didn't realize what Craig was talking about. I hear it now.
Yeah, you hear the portable going.
Yeah.
If you just listen to that ambient sound.
Yeah, because I put on the headphones.
It almost sounds like ocean, the ocean rolling in, you know, when I'm like at the vacation home in North Carolina when I'm renting there during the summer. I hear that, the gentle sound of waves crashing against the shore. Nothing gentle about a hot and muggy day in the studio, however, that's for sure. Hopefully things will cool off and get a little better here. I will tell you this, here in Oklahoma City, it is overcast and kind of gloomy looking there, and they're hoping for good weather to go for the tournament. But I can tell you just by looking at it, well, it looks a little bit better today. Jeff, when I drove up yesterday, I took one glance at the weather forecast, and I was like, yeesh, it looked even more ominous than what we all just went through over the past weekend. It said it was like 60% or 70% every day this week. They've changed it a little bit up here. They'd say it's a 40% chance tomorrow, looks good for Thursday, and then 40% chance the rest of the weekend. And with regard to today, it looks like it'll be all right for that 8-9 play-in game to get things going tonight here in Oklahoma City.
What's a Big 12 tournament without a nice rain delay or two?
Oh boy, I can vividly remember being here, and there was a deal where the Longhorns had won their first two games, and they were and so they got a bye on Friday, which you do. You win your first two games, you stay on the winner's bracket side of the tournament, and then you don't play again until Saturday, either morning or early afternoon, the 9 a.m. or the 12:30 game, and all you have to do is just win your game in the morning session, then you're off for the rest of Saturday, and you're in the championship round. But if you lose, you have to come back and play an elimination, if necessary, game that evening. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened. Texas had won its first two games, and then they were playing Oklahoma State, and they lost the first game. It was a heartbreaker, and then there was another if-necessary game to go, and the skies opened up. And it was just monsoon-like. And so the game got going about 2 hours late, and so it finished up late. But I've been here for many, many a late, late night, Wednesday night, Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night finish. And by the way, for the first time, there holds the promise of a late Sunday finish if you reach the championship, because the championship game has always been at 1 o'clock in the history of the tournament. Not this year. And you wonder about the fact this is the first year that the ESPN family networks will televise the final. It's been on the Fox regional networks in the past. It's going to be on ESPN2 Sunday. So the game time's been shifted to 5 o'clock for the first time ever. It'll be on ESPN2. Coincidence? I think not. So put it this way. If the Longhorns are in the championship on Sunday, and I'll gladly make this deal right now, Jeff, but if they're in the championship game on Sunday, I will not be back in Austin until the very wee hours of Monday morning. And I do need to come back afterwards because Selection Monday is the next day, and it's at 11 a.m. So I'm good with that if it works out that way.
Well, Craig, I'm okay. Let's go ahead and set the table for what we've got today with our normal fare and anything else we've got going on.
Yeah, because we're about to take a break here in a moment, a little bit earlier than we normally do, because coming up in just a few moments, we're going to visit with a national championship head coach, Howard Joffe. The head coach of Texas women's tennis will join us for a few minutes, coming up here in just a few minutes to talk about their championship, the national title, winning that over Pepperdine. So he's going to join us coming up. Then we've got a Longhorn notebook at the bottom. Now, what does the notebook at the bottom of the hour promise for us, Jeffrey?
Baseball, Craig. I want to look at one aspect of this team that I don't want to say we've overlooked it, but I don't think we've given it the kind of props to just do that it deserves with this baseball team for the regular season.
Very good. We'll do that. We do have an inconceivable segment coming up this hour. And then we'll have some other things coming up in the 11 o'clock hour, including a chat with Zach Zubia. I just had breakfast downstairs and got a chance to grab Zub for a few minutes, and we'll hear that coming up in the 11 o'clock hour. So we'll look forward to doing that as well. But we need a break. When we come back, Howard Joffe, Texas women's tennis head coach, joins us to reflect on the school's third ever national title and first under his direction and guidance. You got Craig Way in Oklahoma City. You got Jeff Howe and Snoop Daniel back in the ensconced in the ARN Compound Studios, warmth notwithstanding. This is Light the Tower on the Horn, 104.9, 101.9, AM 1260. We're live, local, and digital on the Horn app and at hornfm.com. Well, it is back on the road with Longhorn Baseball. And here's the really cool deal about it. And coming up on the notebook at the bottom of the hour, Jeff and I will talk some more Longhorn Baseball, is that this is the last time they should be on the road until leaving town for the magical city of Omaha if they qualify for the College World Series, because obviously Selection Monday is coming up, and it's fully expected Longhorns will be a top eight national seed, which means you play at home all the way through the regional and super regional. So, you know, we'll hope that is certainly the case, but they will play tomorrow afternoon, and again, it's scheduled. I do emphasize the word, and Jeff has seen it with his own eyes before, scheduled for 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It's important to emphasize that, because when there's four games in one day at one facility, you know, depending on the length of certain games, things can, you know, drag a little bit. There's 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. It gets going with Baylor and Texas Tech. Tech, the 3 seed, Baylor, the number 6 seed. And depending on the length of that game, it could delay the start of game number 2, which right now is scheduled for 12:30. The 2 seed TCU, the 7 seed Kansas State, and depending on the length of that game, it could delay the start of the 3rd game, which would be, you know, Texas and the winner of the 8-9 play-in, West Virginia and Kansas. They play tonight at 6, and so it could delay that, and then in essence, it could also delay what happens with that. But we'll get to all that later. But right now, joining us on the Vaqueros Cafe and Cantina Hotline, the head coach of the latest national championship team, the 57th national team championship in University of Texas history, 53rd NCAA title, and the 3rd for Texas women's tennis. Coach Howard Joffe joins us on the Vaqueros Cafe and Cantina Hotline. Coach, congratulations. Great to visit with you. How are you this morning?
Very good. Thanks, Craig, and thanks for having me on your show.
Oh, we're thrilled to have you, and I know you're still down in Florida because you definitely have a vested interest in what is still going on, because you've got singles and doubles play to happen as well, and I know you had in addition to that, Kylie Collins and Lulu Sun being able to play and win in doubles as well, and I want to get to some of that, but first of all, I'm always curious to get the thoughts of the head coach on how you process the mountaintop experience of the national championship. We know kids are excited and they're kind of in their own cloud nine universe, so to speak. What about for coaches? How did you take it all in and process being able to coach this national championship team?
Craig, great question. And any other players on my team will know I'm never one who's short for words. In this instance, it's a little bit of a hackneyed cliche. I would say I'm a little bit at a loss and speechless to the extent that it hasn't fully sunk in. I will tell you that anyone that watched on the Tennis Channel the final match, obviously a lot of your listeners may or may not be intimately knowledgeable on how tennis works. So by way of analogy, the match that the championship match that we won would have sort of been like in a basketball analogy, being up by one with 20 seconds to go, being down by one by, 19 seconds, and back and forth in that way, and then one on sort of a buzzer beater. And so watching the match and then having that moment when the final ball was hit and Lulu clinched it for us happen, you can imagine my nervous system had been through the ringer only 15,000 times. And it was actually hard to process that we'd actually won. So I think just the way I described it in of itself, pretty sensational feeling, because you're just running sort of on adrenaline. But just for me as a coach, an old coach now with a lot of gray hair, to see the joy, we had a group that are just lovely people. Obviously, very skilled tennis players, but lovely people fundamentally. To see the joy in their eyes and the jumping and dancing and screaming probably is chicken soup for an old man's soul that will fill me up for a lifetime.
When you knew. When it became apparent that Lulu's match was going to be the deciding match, did you have a good feeling of confidence at that point? Some coaches are completely at ease knowing that it's in the hand of freshmen. Others maybe a little bit more nervous about the moment or the specific matchup. What was going through your mind when it became apparent that her match was going to be the decider?
It's funny. I think like oftentimes one has the luxury from the outside of seeing something and understands the import. I mean, obviously, I'm no dummy. I'm coaching the team and I understood the import. But I was so invested in trying on the changeovers to give Lulu some soulful information that would help get her over the line that the consequences, if you will, of winning and losing didn't occur to me that much at the time. What was interesting, Craig, about that match is what very, you know, for 20-odd years I've been doing this, and what happens so often in matches, and certainly in these deciding matches, like Lulu and the young lady from Pepperdine, is that as the pressure increases, as you your question suggests, as we get closer to this is what it's all for, usually one player starts to sort of wilt under that pressure, and you see a slew of errors again for your listeners, analogous to, you know, teams starting to down the stretch miss free throws or receivers drop passes on that last drive when, you know, and the thing that was so interesting about this match is Lulu raced out to a lead, just a walloping winner after winner. The other kid raised her game. It was so incredibly unusual that with all the marbles on the line, both kids' level of performance got better and better and better as the match went on. And so I feel just very fortunate. I certainly trust Lulu, but I'm very well aware that was swinging and could have swung the other way, on a dime.
For folks who didn't know, the match was tied 3-3, and the freshman Lulu Sun taking on Taisia Pachkaleva, I believe it's how it's pronounced. But anyway, yep. She went up 6-4 and then dropped the second set 6-7, and it goes 7-5 in the final set, and a lot of drama as we visit with Howard Jaffe, Texas women's tennis coach, on the heels of the national championship here on Light the Tower on the Horn with Craig Way and Jeff Howe.
Coach, I think what makes this even more remarkable with the pressure that you just talked about that gets put on young women when they're in a tournament for a national plan with a national championship on the line. Of your six singles players, five of them were true freshmen. How have, in all your years around college tennis, have you heard of that? And what's this experience been like having five true freshmen in your singles lineup?
Yeah, Jeff, excellent observation. Firstly, it's unheard of. I mean, we've all heard of the Fab Five at Michigan. I was way back when college player when Michigan had that great basketball team. But yeah, five of our six starters, genuine freshmen. And the thing over the course of the year that I knew going into the year is, as tennis players, just independently their skills, their abilities, we had a team that was perfectly capable of winning it. But when you've got five of your six starters who have never done it in the cauldron that is college tennis and the pressure associated with it, the big charge on me and in turn on our players was over the course of the year to have some personal growth. You know, I'd said to the team early in the year that the degree to which the freshmen were able to grow and mature and have whatever we'd like to call the term, poise, psychological toughness, whatever that might be, that would define how far we went. And I think that the freshmen really did, for lack of a sillier way to say it, grow up. We had lost in the final of the national indoor to North Carolina, where we were in a commanding lead, and a couple of these young folks unraveled. And I think in a way that defeat paved the way for the growth that was necessary over the next 3 months to make the other night an actuality.
Interesting, Howard, that you bring up the loss to North Carolina. I was going to ask you about the fact that, of course, North Carolina lost to Pepperdine in the other semifinal, and I thought, well, maybe the opportunity to, as they say, balance the books went by the boards there. And then, of course, the reality is, though, you were going up against, from a tennis perspective anyway, your alma mater, since you spent 3 years at Pepperdine. What was that come full circle experience like for you to see your group go up against the team where you played in the early 90s?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of in the aftermath something to ponder and all the rest of those things. Of course, this isn't a television show. If you saw me, you'd see the gray hair. and understand that my time at Pepperdine was literally a good lifetime and a half ago. And so certainly in the match, there was, you know, no sentimental thoughts about going against my former school. But I will tell you, Pepperdine has an excellent team. And, of course, I'm only for the Longhorns. And so it was very nice in the aftermath of the match. I, walking to the press, met with some of the Pepperdine administration and so forth. And they were just tremendously gracious. And I had a great time there. But, boy, oh, boy, am I happy the Texas Longhorns won.
I want to get one more bit of thought from you, Howard, and that is on the fact that it was this incredible experience, and I know folks get excited about it and say, hey, here's a national championship, and yet I also know in your mind and in the minds of some of your players, there's still work to be done. I pointed out that Kylie Collins and Lulu Sun got a doubles victory yesterday, so singles and doubles are still going on. So how do you recalibrate with the players you still have competing on the individual level for championships?
Yeah, I mean, it is such a good question and an interesting one. A little nuance in our sport is the team event happens and then directly after is the individual. And over all the years, I was a college tennis player and now obviously a coach. It's just human nature that the teams that go to that final day, we finished at like 11 o'clock at night. By the time everyone settled from celebrating, it was the wee hours of the morning, to have to come back and play the next day. It's just human nature. It could be analogous for your listeners to have Tom Brady win the Super Bowl and the next morning, report for optional training camp. You know, it's just unheard of. And so I think the players are playing a little bit like chickens with their head cut off by memory and adrenaline. I know that Lulu's singles match was just unbelievably demanding physically, and then, of course, the emotion of it. And so we'll see how they go tonight. They beat a very good team from Notre Dame yesterday, and they play a team from Carolina tonight. And, you know, obviously we're always looking to win, but I think anything that they can do here is just gravy and punctuates one of the better and most memorable seasons ever.
He's Howard Joffe. He's the head coach of the national championship Texas women's tennis team. They got a chance to light the tower in their own special way. And Howard, we couldn't be happier for you. I'm thrilled for you. And I know, like I said, even though there's still work to be done for some of your kids, the excitement is very palpable and understandable and well-deserved. I appreciate you taking the time. And enjoy the rest of your time down there in Orlando. We'll look forward to seeing you back in town.
Thank you guys so much for having us on your show. Have a great day.
You too.
Thanks, Coach.
All right.
Cheers.
That's
Cheers.
Howard Joffe, the Texas women's tennis coach. And great story, great ride. And, of course, yeah, I know it's incumbent upon some Longhorn fans to point out he had been at Texas A&M and came over feeling that he'd had an opportunity to achieve some great things, and certainly has done that at the highest level with the national title now. But the irony not lost to me that it was against his alma mater that they beat Pepperdine in the national championship. So it's great stuff, a great visit there with Howard Joffe. It is now, however, time for the notebook.
Jeff Howe's Longhorn Notebook, brought to you by Cedar Park Overhead Doors. Go to cpdoors.com.
And, you know, like I say, he pointed out that Kylie Collins and Lulu Sun won in the doubles championships yesterday, and now they have to move on to the next round to take on North Carolina in the round of 16 to their doubles teams. So there's your update on tennis. We move forward with, what, some baseball?
Yeah, Craig, I want to do regional projections and maybe just some college baseball potpourri, if you will,
sure,
next hour, because I won't be here tomorrow, so we'll cover as much as we can in the 2 hours we've got today. Tomorrow, by the way, I'll be down in Houston. Steve Sarkisian speaking, doing a luncheon with the Touchdown Club of Houston, so I'll be down there tomorrow and have a full report on that when I'm back in the building on Thursday. But I digress. Craig, you know, what's one thing that you constantly hear, like when things are going bad with this baseball program, no matter who the coach is, what's the one constant you hear? Oh, this team can't hit, can't recruit hitters. You need hitters. You got to get more hitters. Well, now that we're through a regular season, where Texas won 40 games and won a share of the Big 12 championship and is the number one seed in the Big 12 tournament, they've got some guys that can hit. And I just want to put this in comparison, Craig, to another tremendous year and just how kind of historic this is. So you've got Mitchell Daly leading the way with a .350. And I know batting average is not the be-all, end-all, but I'm using it just for an example for the purposes of this segment. Mitchell Daly leading the way with a .354 average. Ivan Melendez next at .346. Cam Williams hitting .308. Zach Zubia at .297. And Douglas Hodo at .291. Craig, do you know the last time Texas ended a season with five guys hitting .290 or better?
It's got to go back, because even I know that the 2002 National Championship team as a team batted .280, which is right about what this team is hitting. So I'm going to guess maybe, unless maybe the 2010 team, which was really built on pitching, but the 2010 team or 2009 team.
Yeah, it was 2010 was the last time I found it happen, where you had five guys finish the season hitting .300 or better. Tant Shepard led the way at .337, Russell Moldenhauer at .326, Kevin Keyes at .311, Cole Wallet at .316, and Cameron Rupp at .304. So I don't know, Craig, if Zubia and Hodo can get there. They certainly have a chance to. They've both shown capable of having some hot streaks. So you've got a chance to do something this year at the plate that hasn't been done in over a decade. And I've got to think, Craig, you know, when you go back to – I'm fascinated by this aspect of this baseball program. I'll never forget standing on the field with David Pierce and a couple other reporters after the 2019 season wrapped up with a series with Oklahoma. They knew they weren't going to the Big 12 tournament. And I remember David Pierce on the field saying, I don't know what's going to happen, but I know I'm not going to sit here and be 27-27 again, and things are going to change. And one thing that changed was, Craig, if I don't remember the timeline exactly, but it was a few weeks later, the Troy Tulowitzki hire happened. And getting Tulo in here, and I don't think we can understate the Tulo factor for this team. And I've heard a lot of guys talk about it, and David Pierce has talked about it, just Tulo being a sounding board from the fact that, and I've heard, again, I've heard Zubi and other guys talk about it. Look, if a guy that played the game at the elite level that he did can talk about having slumps and having struggles and needing to make adjustments, then for the players, it's kind of like, well, who am I to sit here and wonder why things aren't going right, and I can make adjustments and eventually figure this out. So he's been a sounding board. He's been a great asset to this program, and I think the approach at the plate is definitely one area where we've seen some things change.
I don't want to overcook this, but having been around this team, and like I said, I just came from breakfast with them from downstairs, and it's the same thing I've seen in Lawrence, in Stillwater, in Arlington, when things weren't good at the start of the year. But I can tell you this for a fact, and like I said, I don't want to overcook this, but the guys, they greatly respect and admire what the instruction and the direction they get from Coach Pierce, and also from Coach Miller, and also from Coach Allen. They do. And they do what they're, you know, not only what they're told, but the way they're taught and directed. Now, having said all that, and David will be probably the first to tell you this, they also, in a different way, hang on every word Tulo tells them.
Yeah.
Watching them in a circle with him, and like in the dugout during a practice, or on the road in a hotel lobby in Fort Worth, where they're all kind of hanging around and listening to him. I mean, it's part of the benefit of having an ex-big leaguer and one who played at a very high level. And Oklahoma State, by the way, has that same dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've got Robin Ventura and they've got Matt Holliday there, so they get some of that same dynamic and that extra kind of juice, so to speak, from a guy who lived it at as high a level as you can get. And I think that carries – a lot of water. And to his credit, David Pierce understood that and knew that. And give credit to Houston Street, who kind of made the connection happen, because Houston knew Tulo so well from their days in Denver together playing with the Rockies, mm-hmm. and understood Tulo's interest in being involved in coaching. Who would any of us have known that? Of course not.
No.
And for him to kind of make that connecting moment happen with Coach Pierce, and then Tulo contacted him, and David tells the story about how it's great. Okay, well, you know, think about it for you know, I'm getting ready to go out of town. I've got some scouting and this. I'll be back in 10 days, and then we'll talk when we get back and see if you still have that interest. But I want you to think about it. 9 days later, he gets the call while he's still out saying, Coach, I still really want to do this. And it went on from there. So I think you're spot on. It was a great addition to the staff. And there's a dynamic that comes from Troy Tulowitzki being on the staff that wasn't quite the same. Even with the Omaha team of 2018, it's different. It's just a completely different take and perspective on things, and I think the guys appreciate it.
By the way, Craig, what did you say the 0-2 team hit that won a national championship?
I was thinking it was about 280, was it not?
The 2021 Longhorns right now going into the Big 12 tournament as a team hitting 285. So they're right there with what's good enough to win a national championship. So, it's impossible to harp too much on the Tulo factor, because it's been a huge deal for this program. But Craig, one thing I wanted to hit on in this notebook segment, that, you know, we talk a lot about hitting, and we've talked a lot about this pitching staff. I mean, when we had Kendall Rogers from D1Baseball.com on last week, Kendall said flat out, with the way Pete Hansen is pitching, that starting rotation, those top three with Ty Madden, Tristan Stevens, and Pete Hansen, other than that crew Vanderbilt's got, where you've got a couple of guys that are going to go pretty early in the draft, you'd be hard-pressed to find a better weekend rotation in college baseball than the one Texas has. And we've seen the growth with the bullpen. Cole Quintanilla is pitching better than he has at any point in his career. And we've seen what Tanner Witt's done down the stretch. And, we didn't see – I thought it was funny. After the game on Saturday, David Pierce said, you know, I had to go apologize to Aaron Nixon for not getting to pitch. But he said, I don't think he minded all that much. Of course, when you win a conference championship, everything's all good at that point. But one thing we haven't talked a lot about, Craig, is the fielding aspect with this team. And considering going into the year, the question marks in the infield, what were they going to do at third base? What was going to happen at second base? And Cam Williams has been the everyday third baseman, Craig, with the exception of maybe here and there when he's needed a day off. And we know Mitch Daly has done a great job taking over at second base. Texas as a team, and don't discount either Zach Zubia and his growth at first base. You know, David Pierce said something, and David said after the game on Saturday, Craig, in regards to Zubia, and I don't know if you guys brought this up in your chat this morning, but there was a time, and remember, you know, Zach went to Tulane with David Pierce. David Pierce gets the Texas job. Zach comes to Texas and has to sit that first year due to transfer rules at the time. But there was a point in Zubia's career where even David said, look, I didn't know if he was going to be able to do anything but DH. I didn't know if he was going to be able to play in the field. And now he's given you a great veteran presence at first base, to the extent, Craig, that when you look at the fielding numbers for this team, considering all the questions they had going into the year, a 980 fielding percentage, that finished the regular season number one in the Big 12. 40 errors, that was the fewest of anybody in the Big 12. 41 double plays turned, that was second in the Big 12 to TCU with 42, so they were one off from the conference lead. And Silas Ardoin, the job he does shutting down a running game, 27 stolen base attempts that Texas faced in the regular season, that was the third fewest of anybody in the Big 12. So you tie all that together, Craig, this is a borderline, maybe even crossing that line into being an elite defensive team.
Yeah, when you're committing right at about three-quarters of an error a game, is it. 0.75, you know you're doing your job. You make a great point about Zubia, and I'm so used to Zach's development, we didn't get into talking about that. We talked more when we're going to hear it coming up next hour, more about the postseason experience. Because remember, for Zubia, it's his first Big 12 tournament in 3 years.
Yeah.
because they weren't there in 19 and there was no tournament last year. So it's his first since 2018, and that was one of the things we talked about. We'll hear that coming up next hour. But the thing that comes to mind for me, and I'm not comparing skill set level or anything like that. I'm comparing the developmental stage of guys where I'm going with this next point. The reason why I'm going down this road is because, as you pointed out, David Pierce said he wasn't sure if Zach Zubia would ever be able to play a field position for them. And we're talking about a guy who, by the way, played quarterback at Straight Jesuit.
Right.
So he was a good athlete, but he needed a lot of work with his footwork. And I know that sounds kind of crazy considering the fact he was a quarterback. And David said he was an option quarterback too. They ran option. And he said, but they needed some work. He needed to work on a lot of things with his footwork. And David said he wasn't sure that he would ever have a position to field. And here comes the comparison part, and I'm not comparing him to this player, comparing situations, okay? So for folks who are here, just listen carefully. I'm comparing situations. There was another guy who fit right in that same slot and that same profile when he played in the Big 12, and he didn't really have a position. In fact, he DH'd virtually his entire career. I'm talking about Max Muncy. When he was at Baylor, he was a DH virtually his entire career. Now, as a Dodger fan, I see the development he's made. Here's a guy who's played first base, second base, sometimes in the same game, can play third base, can even play a little bit of outfield. He developed over time, and he mainly did that through the minor leagues and when he got up to the bigs. But he worked so hard in the fast track to what he's done to become a good, not just – just a representative first baseman, but a good first baseman, defensive first baseman, has been very impressive to see from a guy who really didn't have a position for a time. So that's just something to keep in mind.
And that's it for the notebook for this hour.
Yep. All right. Coming up, we will have our inconceivable segment. That's next. You would think that, you know, being in Oklahoma might just open up the floodgates of inconceivable stories. It did not in this case.
Did you get your Bigfoot hunting permit while you're up there, Craig?
I haven't applied yet. The day's young. Okay. There's a Longhorn baseball workout coming up that I'm going to go to after we get off the air over at Bricktown today. They're going to spend an hour in the cages indoor, and then they get an hour on the field. And I'm going to go over for that and do that. Maybe after that. Maybe I can run and get the Bigfoot hunting permit after
that. Hey, you've got guys on that team that like to hunt. I mean, Austin Todd's not doing much of anything. Go grab Austin, see if you guys can go hunt some Sasquatches later.
See if he wants to hop in the vehicle.
Yeah. Go hunt some Sasquatches.
It's not a bad idea. All right. Inconceivables next. We continue with Light the Tower on the Horn, 104.9, 101.9, AM 1260. We're live, local, and digital on the Horn app and at hornfm.com.
Inconceivable. Inconceivable.
Inconceivable.
Inconceivable.
You keep using the Horn. I don't think it means what you think it means.
Inconceivable always means it's brought to you by our good friend Dr. Matthew J. Crawford, your expert in orthopedic care, fellowship-trained physician. Matthew J. Crawford treats a wide range of orthopedic and sports-related conditions. So, and the office is open, and they're also seeing patients through telehealth. So if you're interested in more, check them out on the web at austin-orthopedics.com.
I'm guessing crooked or buried penis is not something that Dr. Crawford can help you with, Craig. We're getting a lot of text line feedback on one of the ads that ran during the break.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. That's not an orthopedic issue.
Okay.
That's not an orthopedic issue.
I didn't think so.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Folks need to, you know, do your homework on that. That's not that. Listen closely to the ad. That's not an orthopedic situation there, okay? So, you know.
Dr. Crawford, good dude nonetheless.
Yes, he is. Absolutely. This might appeal to Snoop more so than Jeff, because Jeff, you don't exactly strike me as a guy who enjoys a nice glass of wine. Am I correct?
You know, maybe on the the occasion, Craig, that I go to a really nice steakhouse and,
okay.
and get a nice, if there's a nice house wine that goes with the steak, maybe. But other than that, no.
No.
I mean,
no.
If it comes from a box, I'm more likely to enjoy it if it comes out of a box.
Franzia is your friend.
Here's right? how white okay. trash I am, Craig. I will take the bag out of the box, and I'm the guy that walks around the party with the bag.
Like a bladder. You're just carrying the wine bladder with you.
Yeah, pretty much.
That's good. That's good. And I could...
Colostomy bag.
Nobody said that, Snoop. Nobody. But you're a guy that you kind of surprised us by letting folks know you like a good glass of wine, correct?
Who, me? Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes. Oh, yes. What is the one I like? Oh, my God. It begins with a P. I forget what it's called. Anyway.
Pinot Grigio?
Yeah. Pinot. Oh, Pinot. I call it Pinot Noir.
Pinot Noir?
Yes.
Well, there's different. Pinot Grigio is white.
Pinot Noir.
Pinot Noir is a red.
Oh yeah. I like the red one.
Which one?
There you go.
Okay, that's Pinot Noir. That's French. Okay.
Red wine?
Noir is,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. You'd be 40.
Noir meaning for night. Yeah. Okay. Today is National Wine Day. That's why I bring that up. And so there was this survey, do people like white wine or red wine? I'm my descent on my mom's side is Italian, so I grew up a lot around red wine. And I do like a good glass of Merlot or a Chianti with a pasta or a cab. With a steak or something like that. I really like that. So in the four categories of this poll result, they had over 100,000 responses. Do you like white wine or red? And the choices were white, red, rosé, or no wine for me. Okay? White wine, 18% preferred white. That would include Linda, by the way. She likes a nice Chardonnay.
Good to know.
All right. Red, 32%. Rosé, 7%. No wine for me, 43%. Out of that poll result.
Wow.
43%, yeah. Not down with it. They might, rather have a nice distilled beverage or a malted beverage, if you get my drift. It might be one of those kinds of things. Sometimes we get into the deal about ugly jobs, dirty jobs, the whole Mike Rowe thing, some of the tough jobs. And we've talked about that, right? We've talked about the horse heads being made into pet chow.
That's still disgusting.
There. Loading the skinned horse heads.
I think the worst I've seen, Craig, is I watched the Dirty Jobs one time where a guy's job was he had to extract rattlesnakes from the bottom of some kind of pit that they were staying in and had to clean the pit and then put the rattlesnakes back.
Nice. Yeah. Here's a job. I don't know that it falls into that category. It may not be quite as nasty. But how would you like to have the job, along with some others in a group, of counting every single animal and marine life in every national park?
Oof.
Would that appeal to you? Because if it does...
Sounds like a lot of walking.
Well, if it does, you need to move to Kenya, because Kenya is beginning a great wildlife census. They're trying to understand better and protect the more than 1,000 species of animals, birds, fish that are native to Kenya, some of which have seen alarming population declines over the last few decades. So how are they doing? Well, it's kind of like what you said, Jeff. There's a lot of walking, but they're using GPS trackers. They are using aircraft, camera traps, and significant manpower. The KWS, Kenya's Wildlife Service, is planning to count everything from giraffes to the smallest of animals, the dik-dik, which is the endearing cat-sized species. They'll focus on rare species, including the pangolin, often illegally traded, the Sitatunga antelope, aardvarks, and hedgehogs, none of which have ever been counted in their animal census before.
Let me ask you this, Craig.
That's what they're trying to do.
Yeah, no, I'm being serious here. I'm not trying to do radio bit here. This is serious. Aren't there some endangered species that they'll, like, you know, like we have, like you take your dog or cat to the vet and put the chip in them so you can track them if they get lost? Like, aren't there some endangered species that they'll use, like, inject them with, like, the GPS tracker so you can monitor where they are at all times?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they'll do that.
Rhinos, maybe. I think rhinos.
They do that to all kinds of animals.
Yeah.
Sharks.
And that's what they're doing also with this animal that I refer to, the Dik Dik, and it's spelled like DIK-DIK. Dik Dik. It's the name for any of four species of small antelope that are found in the bushlands of eastern and southern Africa. They stand about 30 to 40 centimeters at the shoulder.
Oh, looks like a baby deer.
Look at that little dik dik.
Yeah, the little dik dik. Yeah, so man, you got yourself a little dik dik there. Okay.
I think we just heard a spot that can help you with that problem, allegedly.
We bring it all full circle there. they're counting that. All right, speaking of wildlife, and I heard Bucky and Aaron talking about this, I'd had it targeted as well. Did you hear about this missing fisherman? They got found alive after spending 17 nights in the Oregon wilderness. Harry Burley from Roseburg, Oregon, was reported missing the evening of May 7th by his wife, Stacy, after he failed to return home from a camping trip in the Tokatee area. Burley, who's 69 years of age, was originally due to arrive home the day before. So he didn't show. So then his wife reported him missing. They found his vehicle, the Douglas County Search and Rescue, near a lower trailhead that leads into Twin Lakes on May 8th, and determined the fisherman may have tried to walk to Twin Lakes to fish before heading home. So the trail is in the Umpqua National Forest, which is nestled on the western slopes of the Cascade Mountains. Search teams have been looking for this man since then and even left packages of food on the trail in hopes he'd find them, you know, like they're doing like with the animals. So they look for days and days. On May 16th, they had a big...